Listener supported. WNYC Studios. Very
superstitious. If you're a performer, it's hard to let go of superstitions. But hey, if you want to try, good luck. I mean, break a leg. I'm John Schaefer, and coming up on Soundcheck, the little performance rituals that bring us luck. At least, singers, actors, and musicians seem to think they do. We'll hear about infamous superstitions, like the one about Shakespeare's Scottish play, and we'll open the phones.
The Bowery, they say such things and they do strange things on the Bowery.
Singer Bree Benton created the alter ego Poor Baby Bree after studying the golden age of vaudeville. The little waif's big city adventures on the Bowery are chronicled in a new show called I Am Going to Run Away. Bree Benton joins us to play songs from it in our studio. All of that on Soundcheck after the news. Why it's bad luck to say good luck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, we dive into the world of superstition in music, theater, and more. And Bree Benton, a.k.a. Poor Baby Bree, gives us a performance from her one-woman vaudeville show, I Am Going to Run Away. But we begin with one alarmingly paranoid crowd. And given the number of things that can go wrong with a performance, no wonder that musicians and actors are such a superstitious bunch. There are some things you just don't do. Whistle backstage? Never. Wish a co-star good luck? How dare you? And definitely don't say the name of Shakespeare's play Macbeth aloud. Which could be a problem because the city right now? Full of Macbeth productions. Joining us to talk about some of these strange behaviors is David Cody, theater editor from Time Out New York. Good to see you, David.
Thanks, John. I'm looking over my shoulder here. I'm worried.
I have to say, I wished David good luck just before the mics opened, exactly what I was doing.
When I leave here, I got to double check the elevator, make sure it's actually there, an empty shaft.
Let me start with, there's so many of these superstitions that go with the performing arts, but Verdi's opera Macbeth is at the Met, and there are several other productions of Macbeth and Macbeth-based things, mm-hmm. either currently running or imminent here in New York. That's a lot of places where you can't say the name Macbeth.
I can't even say it at home. My wife, who trained in London to be an actress, she's an audiobook narrator. She won't even let me. I love to quote Macbeth all the time. Now, occasionally you'll want to say, is this a dagger I see before me? Or tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day. But she freaks out. So I can't even say it. But yeah, instead of saying.
Why is that?
Well, the play has witches in it. And there's all this crazy sort of lore that Shakespeare actually incorporated real spells into the text of the play, and this notion that maybe the very first production of it in Elizabethan London, somebody died from a real dagger being used. I mean, there's all this crazy stuff that floats around that productions of Macbeth are inherently cursed or prone to terrible calamities.
Hmm. And has this been borne out? I mean, have we seen terrible calamities?
I've seen terrible Macbeths. Kelsey Grammer in 2000, that cursed me for a few weeks.
If somebody, just loses their mind and actually backstage at the Met tonight utters the word Macbeth, is there an antidote?
There is the cleansing process.
Really?
Yes. And there's no, like many of these superstitions, there's no, agreement over what exactly it is. But it involves some combination of leaving the theater, maybe turning around three times, spitting over your left shoulder, quoting.
Oh, this is the Widdershins thing. You have to spin around Widdershins counterclockwise.
Yeah. I'm learning things all day about this. But and then you're supposed to quote from another Shakespeare play. I always heard it was you have to quote from a comedy. But it can be anything, really, I suppose.
Anything but Macbeth.
And you have to be invited back into the theater.
So the Metropolitan Opera, one of a number of places here in New York with a Macbeth theme, there's that production Sleep No More, mm-hmm. which actually has some fun with this whole superstition, right? They incorporate all of this.
Absolutely. Well, it's a fascinating production, especially if looked at as an adaptation of Macbeth. I mean, because I don't think there's a lot of the text of the play in it at all. In fact, there's very little. It's performed by dancers mostly who aren't speaking lines. So, but the sort of the aura of Macbeth permeates every moment of that show.
And this is the thing where the audience is in motion, moving from one tableau or scenario to another.
It's like a huge performance art installation taking up about two warehouses. And it doesn't look like a traditional production of Macbeth, but it's sort of like the essence of Macbeth.
But they'll say Macbeth.
I'm sure they must.
As opposed to the Scottish play, which is what you're supposed to say.
Or Macker's.
Really?
Yes.
Mackers?
He's playing Mackers over at Lincoln Center.
Well, in fact, at Lincoln Center, Thomas Hampson is singing the role of Mackers in Verdi's Macbeth. Thomas Hampson in the role of Mackers from the Giuseppe Verdi opera, Macbeth, based on the Shakespearean play that you cannot say in the theater. That is one of the many superstitions that have grown up around the performing arts, whether it's theater or music or dance. And we're speaking with David Cody, theater editor for Time Out New York, about just some of them. And Soundcheck listeners, what about you? Are you a performer of some sort? Do you have a pre-show routine or ritual or superstition? Have you ever seen a fellow artist do something very superstitious? You can leave a comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck, or call us, 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692. And again, the webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. And actually joining us on the line now is Billy Mitchell, the historian for the famed Apollo Theater in Harlem. Billy, welcome back to Soundcheck.
It's my pleasure, John. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. Now, I understand there is a kind of superstitious tradition that's developed there at the Apollo.
That's exactly right. The Tree of Hope, which is a tree stump that every amateur contestant rubs before they perform, that came from that superstitious element. People used to rub it for good luck, hoping that they would get jobs, but that became a superstition because a lot of people rubbed the tree back in the old days who stood around that tree, which incidentally was located outside the old Lafayette Theater. It was located on 131st Street and Adam Clayton Powell. Now, back in the old days, unemployed entertainers would gather around the tree and sing, dance, play their instruments, recite poetry. They did that hoping that someone would see them, like what they did, and hire them. Well, before you could snap your finger, booking agents heard about these people performing around the tree, and they came up to Harlem and they started hiring every performer who performed around it. So being hired and superstitious, the performers thought the reason they were hired is because the tree was giving off good luck.
So now, is this just, I mean, you know, we hear the Apollo has had like all the greats performing there over the years. Is it only the amateurs who rub the tree?
Well, it started with amateur night, but when we have shows, you know, people request to be able to rub the tree because they know the tradition. So it's just not that we put it out for amateur night. That's where it started. But when we have concerts sometimes, when we have special events, people ask to rub the Tree of Hope.
And how long has it been there?
Since the 1930s.
Wow.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, man. Billy, I love the idea of the great James Brown going backstage there at the Apollo in 1962 and rubbing the Tree of Hope. Billy Mitchell is the historian for the Apollo. Let's hear James Brown recorded there in 1962. Billy, thank you for calling in today.
It's my absolute pleasure, John. I look forward to speaking to you again.
You know I feel all right. You know, I feel all right, children. I feel all right. Yeah. Believe me, I'm okay. Believe me, I'm okay. Brother,
James Brown, live at the Apollo, 1962, I'll Go Crazy. He sounds like he rubbed that tree of hope and rubbed it real good. You'd heard of this one, David?
No, I didn't. I've been up to the Apollo a few times to review, but I haven't heard of that tradition.
We are learning about lots of superstitions in the performing arts today on Soundcheck. And joining us on the line from Connecticut College is the psychologist Stuart Vise. He's author of the book Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition. Stuart, welcome back. It's been a long time.
Glad to be here.
So you heard Billy Mitchell talking about how the superstition grew up around this tree of hope at the Apollo. It seems like it was, in fact, well, you'll pardon the pun, rooted in some kind of actual truth. You know, people hung around this tree, they got work. Is that how these superstitions happen?
Sometimes they do, definitely. And, you know, while we're on the topic of the theater, for example, the superstition about not whistling on stage or mm-hmm. backstage, do you know about that one?
Right.
And my understanding is that it has it's rooted in the days when there were these big tapestry sceneries going up and down that had to be lifted by pulleys, and the way the crew actually communicated with each other was by whistling. And so if you whistled by, you know, just randomly backstage, you might end up with a fairly large piece of scenery on your head.
I would add to that.
You know, so that has lasted beyond the time when this was the mode of communication.
Uh-huh.
Sorry to interrupt there. But I think the reason for the whistling thing system being put in place also is that in the 18th and 19th century, as stage technology got more and more advanced, they actually were employing sailors backstage as stagehands.
Because they knew the ropes.
They knew ropes.
Literally.
Rigging,
they
yeah.
knew the ropes.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So that does happen. Yeah. And then, you know, after that is no longer the case, the superstition has a life of its own often.
Right. So break a leg, for example. No one seems to know where this one comes from, but it has, Stuart, as you say, kind of taken on a life of its own in the theater. Are theater people, are musicians, singers, actors, do they tend to be more superstitious than the rest of us?
Well, yes. It is the case that there are these different professions where superstition seems to be part of the culture. It's a bonding thing. It's a language that you learn when you enter into that society. And so you have sailors, you have actors. Certainly, sports, baseball is rife with superstitions that are unique to the game and are part of the culture of the sport. So, once you enter into those groups, it is very common. And of course, they have in common, high stakes in many cases, great uncertainty about what's going to happen. If you make a mistake on stage, it's really hard to hide that. You know, mm-hmm. it's going to be seen by many, many people. And so, these are professions that have those sort of features to them.
So, a high-stakes profession. You mentioned athletes, and especially baseball, and I'm thinking of, you know, many managers, when they go out to remove a pitcher, you'll actually see them kind of step over the first base or third base line and not step on it.
Right.
Which is, kind of like, I guess, a grown-up version of step on a crack, break your mother's back, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
There's something similar. The Russian classical pianist Shura Tchaikovsky had a kind of similar thing.
Right. Evidently, he used to always step on the stage with his right foot first. And so this was just a little ritual that he had. And apparently he was a pretty superstitious guy in general. He had a number of superstitions. I don't know them all, but I know that one was that he was sort of compulsive or superstitious about practicing, that he, you know, to not practice was something that he was very frightened to do. Mm. I mean, that's actually, again, there's a superstition that might have a rational piece to it.
Absolutely. But using the right foot to step out on stage all the time, that's just plain old superstition from this guy, Shura Cherkassky. That is Shura Cherkassky playing Chopin, the impromptu number 2 in E-flat, presumably having used his right foot first to step into the recording studio. We're talking about superstition in the performing arts. David Cody's here with me in the studio, theater editor for Time Out New York. And Stuart Vise is with us on the line, author of the book Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition. And Krista is on the line with us from Trumbull, Connecticut. Hi, Krista.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, so you're a singer?
Yes, I'm an opera singer. And there are some unique superstitions in Italy that come across. I don't know if they're unique to the opera or if it's all stage in Italy, but I was singing in South Korea with an Italian tenor, and I had a purple scarf that I was wearing, and he told me that it was terrible luck to go on the stage wearing purple.
Wow.
I don't know where that comes from or why. One other is from a musical in Italy. A costume had peacock feathers in it, and the other actors were making the sign of the horn, which is kind of like the evil eye, you know.
To ward off the evil eye, yeah.
Right.
Wow. David, have you heard the peacock feather thing before?
You know, that was new to me, and it's very interesting because, I mean, I don't know where that comes from. Is proud as a peacock, pride goeth before the fall? Is it something? I will say, though, that back in the 90s, I did a very strange deconstructed version of Othello, and I played a very strange character in it, and my costume incorporated peacock feathers. I won't say how, because if I did, I wouldn't be able to look you in the eye. But it's true. And if I had known...
Family show.
No, not quite.
I mean, I have heard this before, that no peacock feathers should be allowed inside a theater. I've never actually seen anybody do that or freak out because someone else did. But, I've heard of that as a thing, as a superstition.
And also wearing green in rehearsal, apparently, is bad luck.
Now, Krista told us she was an opera singer. There is this this toy thing. Stuart, have you come across this?
No.
David, you've heard of toy.
Yeah, it's the alternative to saying good luck, you know, before a performance.
And the thing is, Stuart, that strikes me about this is you can't just say toy or toy. You have to say it 3 times. And numbers... A lot of these superstitions sort of devolve into numbers games, don't they?
Absolutely, yeah. The ritual bouncing of the basketball X number of times before you take your free throw or whatever. There is a romance in the repeated act, I think, making it sort of an incantation. The other thing too is that sometimes there's a sense of mantra-like soothing that can come from the exercise of a quote ritual or a superstition, depending upon what you call it, and I think there may be some real benefit to that.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that ritual actions or breathing can relieve stress. So
absolutely, yeah. No, and coaches often will recommend if a player does not have one to sort of that the player establish a pregame ritual, sort of doing everything the same way, and I think that's exactly what it is to sort of calm you, give you something to focus on that will keep you from building up anxiety before the performance.
Well, there's a photo on our website of a guitarist at the Apollo Theater rubbing that Tree of Hope that we were talking about before. And, you know, you could see where that would be kind of a, I mean, this thing has been worn smooth over the decades. You could see how that would might be a, like a calming thing to, you know, a calming sensation on a sweaty palm before you head out on that famous stage. Let's go back to the phones, because we've got a couple of people who claim to know the derivation of the term break a leg. And they're different derivations, both of them. Jonathan first in Brooklyn, and we'll also be speaking with Ken in Glen Cove. Jonathan first, how are you, Jonathan?
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
So you know the history of break a leg.
Well, I was told it back in college during my study of restoration comedies and performance of restoration comedy, an infamously foppish form of theater.
Mm-hmm.
And the break a leg, I was told, is to turn the right leg out so that the calf could be seen, to break a leg forward so that you could see the calf. And it was a way of standing on stage when delivering lines. So these were stockinged, and men's in stockings, you would turn your leg outward, and that was to break a leg.
And so the idea is that in those, and we've talked a little bit about this in the world of ballet, too, in Restoration times, a couple of centuries ago, it was the men's legs that everyone was looking at. And so, yeah, to kind of show off a well-shaped calf would have been something important. But, Ken, in Glen Cove, story you've heard, huh?
The story I've read is somewhat different from the one that you just heard. I heard that break a leg referred to the bow that an actor would take after a performance and after he'd had encores. That is, he bent a leg, not broke a leg. And this was to express his pleasure at being applauded. The other part of this same Elizabethan theater ritual was that the groundlings, I guess, but the other people in the theater would frequently throw coins on the stage to express their admiration, and the actor would have to bend his leg. He would have to kneel down in order to pick up the coins. So the breaking the leg was appreciation first, that they liked it.
So it was two things. So it's, yeah, so breaking a leg meant you were getting applause, so you were taking bows, and perhaps picking some change up off the foot of the stage.
You know, the more specific the explanation, the more I believe it.
Well, now, we're not done yet. We're not done, because Corinne has yet another explanation for where the term break a leg comes from, and Corinne is a professional dancer, so I'm going to give her story no more credibility than anybody else's. Go ahead, Corinne. What you got for us?
I was told that the side wing curtains that separate the wing on stage right and stage left, those are actually called the legs. And to break a leg literally meant to be on and off stage so many times for your curtain call to actually break the leg of the curtain, because I was told that in the 1800s, a professional ballerina had so many curtain calls that she got tangled in the leg of the curtain.
Well, that's pretty specific. Good enough for you, David?
Well, that obviously would date the origin of the phrase when we started having curtains in theaters. I don't know. I mean, today, break a leg might mean, you know, get into a show like Spider-Man that is, people get injured, but it runs forever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as Stuart said, you know, very often wherever these things come from, they end up taking on a life of their own. What about, Stuart, things that are specific to one kind of job or another? I mean, you talked about athletes, we've talked about actors and singers. Do these things ever kind of spread into the wider society? Have we picked up superstitions from music or acting or baseball or what have you?
I'm not sure that. I think that they're actually more likely to be stuck within that group. As I say, more as almost a membership thing. I know, for example, that our basketball team, women's basketball team, used to believe that if they went to Dunkin' Donuts the night before a game, that after practice, that somehow made them win. And so they did this as a ritual, and it was something that only they would do, you know, themselves. So I don't think so. I mean, there may be the idea that, you know, if you've been a member of one of these groups and sort of practice this stuff, that you may then, as an individual, start doing things in the other parts of your life. But I don't. Other than that, I'm not convinced that that's the case.
All right. Oh, we're speaking with Stuart Vise. He's author of the book Believing in Magic: The Psychology of Superstition. David Cody, theater editor for Time Out New York. Calls on the line, comments on the website, and Joel Meyer in the control room with some of those comments.
John, you know, we've mentioned the Macbeth superstition and the current Broadway production of Spider-Man in the same segment, John, so I think this one kind of fits in that genre. Ra from Manhattan writes, I was in the audience of the off-Broadway preview of the play Scattergood, starring Brian Murray a couple of years ago. I had just had a new photo taken, and I told my partner that it made me look like Lady Macbeth. Realizing my error, fear overtook me. My partner laughed it off. Sure enough, three-quarters of the way through the performance, there was a crash. Everything stopped. Mr. Murray had fallen backstage. No serious injury, but still, I'll never utter that word again in a theater.
All right, so the Scottish play strikes again, and we end up where we began, knowing nothing more than we began with in terms of where these superstitions come from, only that they are out there, and they have, as Stuart has told us, lives of their own. To everyone who's called and commented, thanks. Glad to hear from you. David Cody, great to have you back with us.
Thanks,
here in
John.
The studio. Stuart Vise, thanks for joining us on the line.
A pleasure.
The song is called Knock on Wood. There are many versions of it. This one comes from Amy Stewart. Up next, a live performance from Bree Benton, a.k.a. Poor Baby Bree. She brings a taste of her one-woman vaudeville show live to our studio. And then later on the show, we remember the revolutionary banjo player, Earl Scruggs, who passed away yesterday. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Poor baby Bree. She's an orphan. She's dressed in rags. And her dreams of joining the circus, that's circus, didn't quite work out the way she planned. The vaudevillian character is the alter ego of Bree Benton, who's been performing as Poor Baby Bree since 2005. Next month, the street urchin returns to the stage in her upcoming one-woman show, I Am Going to Run Away. And today we get a preview here in the Soundcheck studio. This is Bree Benton as Poor Baby Bree, with her music director Franklin Bruno at our piano, and the song's called I've Got a Pain in My Sawdust.
Oh, gee, thanks, John. Thanks an awful lot. Now, say, all you kiddies out there, what are you doing listening to the radio? Why, I'll bet it's just about time for your nap. So lay your heads down, and sweet dreams will come to you all wrapped up in pretty paper with a big fat ribbon. And I'll tell you a little story about a doll I know. A little cloth doll and a little bisque doll and a dolly imported from France were sitting one day on the shelf of the store with a doll that could wind up and dance. When all of a sudden the shopkeeper heard a scream that rang out through the store. And this was the plaint of the little cloth doll that made such an awful uproar. I've got a pain in my sawdust, that's what's the matter with me. Something is wrong with my little insides, I'm just as sick as can be. Don't Don't let me faint, someone get me a fan. Someone else run for the medicine man. Everyone hurry as fast as you can. I've got a pain in my sawdust. They took her away in a hospital van, and the whole town was filled with the blues. For everyone thought it was quite an odd thing, and the papers all printed the news. The surgeons looked wise, and they all shook their heads and asked her just where she was sick. I think it's appendix sawdust, she exclaimed, and won't you please do something quick? I've got a pain in my sawdust, that's what's the matter with me. Something is wrong with my little insides, I'm just as sick as can be. Oh, don't let me faint, someone get me a fan. Someone else run for the medicine man. Everyone hurry as fast as you can. I've got a pain in my sawdust. Oh, sad was the day for the little cloth doll, for they cut all her stitches away and looked for the seat of the terrible ache. 'Twas a delicate task, they all say, for none of the surgeons had ever before performed on a dolly's inside. They tried to restuff her but didn't know how, and this was her wail as she died. I've got a pain in my sawdust, that's what's the matter with me. Something is wrong with my little insides, I'm just as sick as can be. Oh, don't let me faint, someone get me a fan. Someone else run for the medicine man. Everyone hurry as fast as you can.
That is Poor Baby Bree, a.k.a. Bree Benton, singing live in the studio. Franklin Bruno at our piano. The song is called I've Got a Pain in My Sawdust. Wow.
From 1909.
Yeah, most of it. Although, Franklin, a little interpolation towards the very end there from somewhat later on.
It can't be much later. It can't be later because it's written in the sheet music.
Is it really?
Yeah. Gounod.
It's the funeral march from...
Funeral March of the Marionettes.
It wasn't... It's pre-Alfred Hitchcock.
Pre-Alfred Hitchcock. It was the theme song for Alfred Hitchcock's TV show, which was much later than 1909. But you're right. It must... Gounod, 19th century. So that was not an interpolation. That's actually part of the song.
Yeah, that's all part of it.
And this is a lullaby? This is something for kids to sleep to? The doll is going to die?
No, it isn't, but I had to present it somehow.
All right. Now,
for the radio.
So now how do you do this? Do you, like, go sifting through these old archives of songs and...
Yeah, I go to antique stores and used bookstores and wherever else I can find sheet music, and I look through piles, and I hunt for songs we can use for the shows.
Do you already have a story in mind, or do you like to...
Well...
Let stories suggest themselves?
The songs help me with the story.
Okay. So Poor Baby Bree is the character, and maybe when you set out to do a show, you're not entirely sure how it's going to go until the songs come into the picture? Is that how it works?
Right. Well, I had so many songs to begin with, and I thought, well, what am I going to do with all these? And a couple of them were about the circus.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think about the show some more, and then I would go to some place like Buffalo and find a song called I Am Going to Run Away. And so it all started to make sense.
So the show is called I Am Going to Run Away, and it starts on April 13th at the club at La Mama in Lower Manhattan for 3 weekends. And what is the story here? Is it as simple as little girl running away to join the circus?
It's as simple as that.
It's
the sort of story that you find in a lot of pre-code movies.
Pre-code movies.
Yeah.
Pre-haze code, pre-censorship.
Right.
Also, I mean, it's almost, I mean, obviously we're making sounds, but it has a silent movie plot or feel coming from stage melodrama of the period, both musical and non-musical, as it would have been performed
A
long time ago.
We spent the first half of the show talking about superstitions, you know, theater folks. I mean, vaudeville must have been full of them.
Tons of superstitions in vaudeville. I don't remember any right now, though. Now, what about the hat on the bed? That could have come from vaudeville.
I'm not familiar with that.
That's bad luck to have, to put your hat on the bed. You find that seems to show up in some 30s gangster movies. Like whoever throws their hat on the bed definitely gets killed. Is definitely going to get shot by Guy Kibbe or something.
All right, but the two of you don't have some kind of vaudeville era thing that you say to each other before you go out on stage or anything like that?
No.
Okay. So what era is Poor Baby Bree from?
Poor Baby Bree is from anywhere from... I don't know, early to mid-19th century through the 30s, through the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. So
I guess.
She covers a lot of ground.
Yeah.
Well, depending on the emphasis, and the reason that you say that is because that accent that you've developed was a common... It's not a particular borough. It's closer to what, in our understanding, was a common New York accent.
Mm-hmm. It almost has a Cockney kind of sound to
it. Yeah, almost.
It has bits of a lot of things, but it was fairly commonplace, certainly well up to the Warriors. Someone told me just yesterday after seeing us that that her voice reminded him of her his maternal grandmother, who had grown up as a German Lower East Sider and a survivor of the General Slocum disaster. And it's great for both of us, but especially Bree, I suppose, when we hear that someone who remembers people talking like that feels like it relates to their lives.
Well, and certainly makes sense, you know, huge immigration during this period of time that we're talking about. Now, the song you're going to do, Bree, next comes from 1895.
Yeah, that's it.
The Belle of Avenue, and that's spelled A-V-E-N-O-O, Avenue A. So is this now, are we settling in the place where most of the story takes place?
We're settling near the place where our other show happens. We do another show of historic songs of the Lower East Side, and this next song is from that.
Okay, let's hear it. It's Bree Benton singing, Franklin Bruno at the piano, the new show called I Am Going to Run Away, featuring all these songs from the vaudeville era, opens on April 13th. But we're getting a bit of a preview today on Soundcheck.
And now, kiddies, come along with me to the East Side. Come on. A little further. Ah, here we are, and ain't it grand? Now, there's a rumor going around the folks here ain't got class. Well, I say they got plenty, sure. Take Sadie over on Avenue A. Oh, gee, but she's got refinement. Now, you can't see this, but I got here a pair of genuine brass knuckles. I won them from her in a crapshoot. The Belle of Avenue A, that's what they call Sadie. And the way she talks... She's awful tough, and so beautiful, and so tough. I am the belle, they say, of Avenue A, and if you're strolling down that way, you're pretty sure to see me on the street. Cause I'm something of a walker, and the fact that I'm a corker is the talk of every corper on the beat. Billy McNeely is me steady, and you'll always find him ready for a scrapping match or any kind of fight. He's the bouncer down at Cleary's, and he says of all the fairies, I'm the only one he thinks is out of sight. Get off the eight, and don't attempt to stay, cause I'm a queen, the belle of Avenue A. Ta-ra-ra-ra-ra-ra-ra, I am the belle. they say I'm giving away. And you can bet your stuff that I'm up to snuff. It fairly makes me smile to take on my style, cause I'm the belle, they say I'm giving away. You wanna see me spill with Billy McNeil. He is a bouncer and he's loaded with sand. I may be gay, but say, well, that is my way, cause I'm the belle of Avenue A. Billy McNeil, he says to me, he says, you're the stuff, says he. He says, there ain't no other girl that's half so sweet. And if I marry you, says he, I swear that I'll be true, says he, and we will make a pair that's hard to beat. Cause if he really tries, he'll take a fella twice the size, and he will tomp up till he can't begin to see. While as sure as my name's Sadie, I can polish any lady what is anxious for to have a scrap with me. Get off the eight and don't attempt to stay, cause I'm a queen, the belle of Avenue A. Ta-ra-ra-ra-ra-ra-ra. I'm the belle, they say, of Avenue A. And you can bet your stuff that I'm up to snuff. It fairly makes me smile to take on my style, cause on the belle, they say, of Avenue A. You wanna see me spill with Billy McNeil. He is a bouncer and he's loaded with sand. I may be gay, but say, well, that is my way, cause on the belle of Avenue A.
The Belle of Avenue A, an 1895 song sung here in our studio by Bree Benton with Franklin Bruno at the piano. Bree, once again, is assembling a lot of early 20th century songs for her new show, I Am Going to Run Away. Franklin is the music director for that, and it's opening April 13th at the club at La Mama. I got to say, I know that song was in English. I really could use a translation for half of that.
What words would you like?
There were words I couldn't even, I'm not even sure what they were. It seems like a lot of fairly obscure.
Spiel. Do you know, you ought to see me spiel with Billy McNeil. It's dancing.
Spiel is dancing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Spieling was a particular kind of dancing that Lower East Siders, kids of the street, would do a lot of spinning. This is very much the atmosphere anyone who's out there has read Luxon's Low Life.
Right, right.
These things are really coming from a similar space and a period.
Now, do you ever change the lyrics to kind of update them? I mean, some of this, you know, they were...
No, I never update them, but I have had to change lyrics to fit a story before. Like, there's a song that we do in I'm Going to Run Away called The Sneak, which is about indigestion. But I changed it, so it's about insomnia.
Oh, okay.
I didn't have to change it much.
Well, it's about insomnia caused by indigestion.
I took out the indigestion part.
You took out the references to gout,
yes.
Actually.
So just for purposes of the story. So the story is poor baby Bree. She's dressed in rags. She's an orphan. She's running away to join the circus. I guess we can assume things are not going
to go. I actually have parents in the show. I'm not an orphan in that show.
Ah, okay.
A runaway, though.
But still poor. Still poor baby Bree.
Oh, yes, I'm poor.
There's another song you wanted to do for us. There, Little Girl Don't Cry. Now, this is in the new show?
Yeah, this is in the new show.
And this song's from when?
It was set to music in 1919. It's a poem by James Whitcomb Riley.
Yeah, all right.
From the 1880s.
Popular 19th century sentimental poet. This song, I think, has had several musical settings, and this would be more typical of something that would be performed as a parlor song in the Stephen Foster sense, like bought by private individuals for their new pianolas, more than a vaudeville performance song, but we're using it in our show.
All right. It'll be as part of the show called I Am Going to Run Away. Bree Benton and Franklin Bruno playing it live on Soundcheck.
Now look. I'm just about through singing, and then I'm getting out of here. But don't start crying about it. I mean it. Oh, I can see it now. A little girl out there, kind of like me, getting ready to cry all over herself. Oh, little girl, don't let it get to you.
And maybe one of these days, the sad things, they ain't gonna hit you so hard. But for now. There, little girl, don't cry. They have broken you down, I know. And your tea set blue, and your play house too, are things of the long ago. But childish troubles will soon pass by. There, little girl, don't cry. Little girl, don't cry. They have broken your slate, I know. And the glad wild ways of your schoolgirl days are things of the long ago. But life and love will soon come by. There, little girl,
There, Little Girl, Don't Cry, a song from 1919 that features the voice of Bree Benton and Franklin Bruno at our piano. Bree plays the role of poor baby Bree in the forthcoming show, I Am Going to Run Away, The Sounds of a Lost New York of the 19th and early 20th century, coming to life in the new show starting April 13th at the club at La Mama. Performance is 3 weekends. And Bree, Franklin, thank you both for coming in and giving us a bit of a preview today.
Thanks, John.
And still to come, we take a moment to honor the late Earl Scruggs, who revolutionized the banjo, next on Soundcheck.
He sold me a pair of socks, then said he how much for the box. Someone said $2.
Well, the first thing you know, old Jed's a millionaire. Ken folks said, Jed, move away from there. He said, California is the place you ought to be. So he loaded up the truck and they moved to Beverly Hills, that is, swimming.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. And we wanted to take a moment today to mark the passing yesterday of Earl Scruggs. Scruggs was to the banjo what Hendrix was to the electric guitar, or what Paganini was to the violin, by which I mean he revolutionized the sound of the instrument. And when singer-mandolinist Bill Monroe hired him in 1945, they ended up creating a whole new genre of music, bluegrass. American TV audiences in the 60s knew Scruggs from his theme music for, and occasional appearances in, the Beverly Hillbillies. But almost every person who's picked up a banjo in the last half century will remember Earl Scruggs for his most famous piece of music, the Foggy Mountain Breakdown. Recorded with his longtime partner, guitarist Lester Flatt, Scruggs' Foggy Mountain Breakdown won a Grammy in 1969. Earl Scruggs' distinctive sound was created by using picks on his thumb, index, and middle fingers. It's a sound that inspired, among others, the multiple Grammy-winning banjo player Bela Fleck and the comedian, actor, and banjo man, Steve Martin. Last time he was on Soundcheck, Steve Martin said he was 16 or 17 when he first fell under the spell of the banjo and of one player in particular.
Well, I'd have to say it was Earl Scruggs. He was the great... It's a sound that, if you have any inclination toward the banjo, when you hear it, you really do say, what's that? What's that sound? And I can remember listening to the music, and it was like the only sort of analogy I can think of is it's like the Red Sea, and you're parting all the other instruments orally to get to that sound. And you're moving the guitar aside in your head, and you're moving the mandolin aside, and you're moving the fiddle aside, and you're trying to focus in on that sound of that five-string banjo.
Steve Martin actually got to record this version of Foggy Mountain Breakdown with his hero in 2001, and Earl Scruggs won a second Grammy for this recording. Earl Scruggs died yesterday in Nashville. He was 88. The late Earl Scruggs and friends, including Steve Martin playing the second banjo, and that's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow, we're live in the green space with violinist, singer, and film composer Andrew Bird, plus Saturday Night Live alum Anna Gasteyer and her band join us to preview her swingin' cabaret show, Elegant Songs from a Handsome Woman. Tune in for our live webcast tomorrow at 2 at wnyc.org/soundcheck. Our technical director is Irene Trudell, the program produced by Katie Bishop and Greta Cohn. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer. We had help today from Gina Gildasis. I'm John Schaefer. Tune in tomorrow for the next Soundcheck.